White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is the White Aryan Resistance Radio Network. Your host for today's show is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy. So get a spot of tea, sit down and relax, because it's time for another show on the White Aryan Resistance Radio Network.
UFOcradio.com. Joining me today is the legend Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy. Tom, are you with me?
Good morning.
Good morning, and it's great to have you with me. And I mean, I was listening before catching up today to record this show. You did a show some years ago, and you went through your background, how you came into this you know, white nationalist movement. And I mean, there's very few people that you haven't met and you haven't been involved with. You started back in the early 60s.
Right.
And I wondered if you could run through your bio, and I'll just let you talk through, you know, anything that you'd like, and I might come up with a few questions, but really hand over to you and you tell us your story.
Well, here's the way it goes. We're getting some feedback, but here's the way it goes. First, I found a cave, and then I hung a flag on the front of it. We called it Cave 454, and that's where I began.
Excellent.
Oh, I'm just kidding. Anyhow, well, in 64 was my first political outing, and that was in the Barry Goldwater campaign. The Republican Party had, and he was sort of representing the more radical conservatives, and which really didn't seem very radical to me considering the shape of the country. But I started out as a long time in the anti-communist thing and the Cold War and all that, and I spent a lot of time in that and spent a lot of money in that. And I spent after I worked on the Goldwater campaign, I joined the John Birch Society, and I was in the John Birch Society for about 9 years, and I was chapter leader and things like that. I worked on the, the George Wallace campaign. I ran a headquarters for him twice. Early on, I worked in the headquarters for Ronald Reagan until I found out he was a rat. And so then I ran for county commissioner in the town I lived in California and lost. And then I ran for United States Congress and won the Democratic nomination with about 59,000 votes. But I was up against a 9-term incumbent who was in a Republican district, and I ran as a Democrat. So even if I'd have been loved by all these liberals, I would have never got elected. But I did get a lot of votes and got a lot of publicity, and it was pretty much a worldwide story. And that was in 1980. And from 75 to 80, I ran the KKK of California as the director. I never used those antiquated terms, you know, like Grand Imperial Poopa and all that stuff. I was simply the director. Our uniforms were black uniforms with black combat boots and black police helmets and all that kind of stuff. And we went through several riots out there. But I pointed out to the right wing in this country that I didn't lose my riots. We put some of the commies in the hospital. We put the Progressive Labor Party, we tangled with them in a couple of places, and we outsmarted them all the time, and we did a lot of tactical training. I noticed ever since then, the right wing does not have tactical training. They just go out and say, we're going to walk down the street and we're going to have a parade, and they get attacked and they get beaten and everything else. Well, that didn't happen with us. They tried it, but we were equipped. We had different defense mechanisms and so forth, and even guns. And so none of my men ever was arrested in one of those demonstrations, and none of my men ever went to the hospital in those demonstrations, so we must have done something right. But after the riot in Oceanside, California in 1980, which I was going to go into a park and give a speech about running for Congress, we were attacked by about 200, mostly white lefties. I find that when it gets down to the actual physical fighting, the blacks aren't that numerous. They may be numerous leading up to the attack, but once the fists start flying, usually the blacks take off and you're confronted by other white people. Anyhow, I only had 30 men at that thing, you know, and the cops even turned on us.
Wow.
As we said, we're going to leave the park now. We said what we had to say. It got so rough in that riot that the highway patrolman crawled underneath his cruiser to get out of the way. That's how bad it was. So then we're leaving the park and going to go, and here's the mob coming on our tail. And then the police, about 100 of them, got in between us, and that allowed the creeps to throw rocks and everything else. They shot one of our dogs. But we got out of there without being hurt. And so anyhow, that was the last time I did that type of thing where there's a riot, because you can't win. There's no way of winning that way. If the creeps don't get you, the cops will. The best riot we ever had was on a day that the cops had a strike, a union strike, and the cops stayed home that day. And the Progressive Labor Party, that was up in San Francisco, they chose that day to attack us because we were having a meeting at an American Legion Hall up there, and they attacked, but usually they always make sure the cops come and get in between us. Well, the cops didn't get in between us, and we beat the living hell out of them. We put some of those guys in a hospital. Anyhow, that was my wild man days, and I decided that's not the way it's going to work. I'm not saying there can't be ruthless application of muscle, but you can't do it that way. So then I ran for Congress, and I left the Klan, and let's see now, what was my next step? Oh, yeah, let's see. So then I started the White Aryan Resistance.
That's what you've got now, which is resist.com, for the benefit of the listeners. If they go to resist.com online, they can join there and subscribe to your shows, etc.
But I didn't start it up as a membership organization because I saw that all these membership organizations failed. All the right-wing membership organizations eventually fail. And I, as a White Aryan Resistance, there were no members on paper at all. And so later on, I brought in what we call lone wolf, a lone wolf position and leaderless resistance. And I've been that way ever since, and it's worked great because we have people all over the place. There's no membership cards, no meetings, no flags flying, no uniforms. They're just integrated into the public and try to get jobs in key positions. And it drives the opposition crazy, drives the FBI crazy because they don't know who we are. They may find out. They know who I am, but the lone wolves don't make contact with me. And so we're all over the place. We don't even know how many are out there because I told the skinheads several years ago to forget the skinhead thing, grow your hair out, get a good job, go to college, and burrow into the system. You know, like if you could get a job inside MI6, that would be the perfect thing for us. Yeah, well, they need more and more FBI because of the situation all over Europe, all over the United States. So it's not that hard to get into the FBI if you don't have tattoos all over yourself and if you don't have a record of belonging to a right-wing organization. It's not that hard to do. Okay, so...
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, that was a point. What I meant with white Aryan resistance is the membership is if you want to get radio shows, etc. But the actual concept that you set up of this lone wolf situation has been amazing. Because that's, as you say, how they've always got people. And that's why they always try. They'll go out there and they'll get people to set up various means of resistance to this global governmental tyranny and this Jewish power. And they'll get people to set up anti-Jewish groups or nationalist groups. And all they are just gathering places for your names, addresses, so they can keep track of who their enemies really are. But what you've got, of course, as you say, people are aware of you. You're not aware of them. People can go and I encourage them to join your radio show that you do. But apart from that, the whole lone wolf situation was set up by yourself.
Yeah, and a lot of our undercover lone wolf types don't have any contact. They don't even get the radio show. But once you know the party line, you know the party line. Once you know what hurts the enemy and what helps us, you've got it. So you don't have to go to meetings and have people like me tell you what you should know already. People should educate themselves and then become lone wolves. And if they want to have contact, if they want to be totally undercover, they do that. So we're not out to make a lot of money. We don't make a lot of money the way we operate. But
how about the I remember hearing that the Birch Society, and you were involved and you set up a few chapters of that, and then someone in the Birch Society tried to tell you what books that you could and couldn't read. Could you tell me about that?
We had a regional director that came around to talk to the individual units every once in a while. And we had a big meeting in the town, near the town where I lived, and he got up in front of the group. I was only about 10 or 12, and said, now look, we've got a problem here. You see all these books on the desk here? And he started reading them off, and he said, you can't read these books. And if you find your members reading these books, you got to get rid of them. And he started reading them off, and I stood up and I said, I've got every one of those books in my library, and nobody's telling me what to read. I don't care, right, left, middle, Republican, Democrat, or what. I read whatever I want and whenever I want, and I walked out and quit the John Birch Society. So they were, yeah. they were actually being what they said they were fighting. You know, they said they're fighting, you know, dictatorship and Marxism and all that. But in fact, they are acting just like those people, only on a different plane, you know. But I wasted a lot of time because at that point I was not a full-blown racist. And in fact, I went along with the Birch Party line, the Birch Society line, when they said, well, if you're into the race situation, you're working for the communists. And I bought that line, and it was a bogus line. It was it just was not true, really. And so I got involved with the anti-tax movement, refusing to pay income tax. I refused to pay income tax to finance the Vietnam War. I lived just a few blocks from the largest military Marine base in the United States, Camp Pendleton, and I knew a lot of Marines, and we had a lot of Marine buddies. And I talked to them before they went over to Vietnam, and I talked to them after they come back from Vietnam. And the stories they told me, I decided this is bullshit. We got to get out of this thing. So I'm not going to pay income taxes to support this thing. Well, it was a noble gesture. The IRS tried to seize my house a couple of times, but luckily they didn't get it. And that's when I started becoming more racially aware. I remember I went up to Richard Nixon's house in San Clemente. The left was having a big demonstration there, and so I went up to demonstrate against them. And a little old lady stuffed a newspaper in my hands and said, "You need to read this." And I never will forget it. It was the Thunderbolt. You might remember that, the Thunderbolt newspaper. It was a really radical, racial, national socialist type paper. And that sort of rocked me back on my heels, and I got to reading more and more racial stuff and gradually became a full-blown racist. In fact, I don't know, 10, 12 years ago, I left the right wing because they said they were going to kick me out. And I said, you can't kick me out. I quit because I didn't like the way they operated. I didn't like the leadership was phony and money-grubbing and hypocrites and all like that. So I said, I'm just a racial separatist, a white racial separatist. I'm not right, I'm not left, but I'll use anything that I see that's a good thing to use from either side. There's a lot of my positions now are quite left, and some are still right. And then we have our own. So you ask some of the right wing, they're like, "Oh, that Metzger, he's a Bolshevik. Metzger's this or Metzger's that." But I don't care because I'm effective.
Yeah, I think that there's been times in I remember listening that you actually got involved. You had a common enemy with the left wing, and your organization at the time and the left-wing organizations basically agreed to put aside their differences and unite to fight this enemy, and you were quite deadly in that respect.
Well, I'm very much anti-war. I'm anti the big banks. I guess you'd call me more of a populist, a racist, as racism used to be in this country back in the old days. I'm strong on the environment, and a lot of the things the left wing stand for, I agree 100% with, except the race issue. And so I'm dead set against capitalism, predatory capitalism. I oppose it all the way, and like that. So
I think that what they've done is by making the race issue and diversity of races, excuse me, an integral part of being left-wing, it's kind of destroyed the working man. It's destroyed the working class, because now if you're working class, you're you follow rights for working class people. Immediately thrown within that is rights for homosexuals, rights for blacks, Jews, whatever, transgenders these days. And so they immediately put that in there when it would never have been part of it in the past. And so that kind of nullifies the threat that the working class or left have against the system, because they put in place things that the normal man on the street wouldn't agree to anyway. What do you think about that?
I agree. There's a lot of stuff in the left wing that I couldn't possibly accept. But on the other hand, I've had the idea that, in fact, I ran as a Democrat when I ran for Congress, and then I ran for U.S. Senate. I got about 80,000 votes when I ran for U.S. Senate, of working inside the Democrat Party, because there was more working-class people were Democrats, and more of the plutocrats were in the Republican Party. So I can't work with the Republican Party. If I had to do it and I had the control of the right wing, I'd say, all you guys, join the Democrat Party and let's take over the party. And if we have to have brawls inside these meetings, take it over. It wouldn't take too much violence to take over the Democrat Party from the inside. There's things like that we can do. You know, like I go to these meetings, Democrat meetings. They hate it when I walk in, but they can't do anything about it. And they, in fact, they even try to hide when the meeting's going to be. So I don't get in there. And I got tossed out of the Republican Party meeting early on. I just wanted to see what the hell they were talking about. And it was at the country club only a few blocks from me. And they wouldn't let me in. So anyhow, I think we should invade the meetings of our enemies. And you can recruit a lot of people that way. When you have the balls to do that, you get respect. I get a lot of respect from people who disagree with my racial views a lot, but they like the way I operate, and they know that I'm not a phony, and I'm not afraid to walk into a room full of progressives or left wingers or whatever. I walk into Jew meetings too. I mean, hell, I've even put on the yarmulke and walked into Jew meetings. I just came back from Israel about 30 days ago. And that was because this Christian fellow, he's an older man, he's 92 years old, he said, Tom, your views on Christianity or religion are terrible. I'm going to send you to Israel and get your mind right. So he put up the dough, and I went to Israel, went all over Israel, and came back. And I figured I'd have a big problem in Israel. I figured that the ADL and all of them would let them know, and they'd stop me at the airport and turn me around and send me home like they did my son years ago in Germany. But nobody gave me any trouble at all in Israel. Everybody treated me fine in Israel, so that's an interesting situation that they hadn't been tipped off, or maybe they figured by making a big deal out of it would go worse for them than just ignoring me unless I caused violence. But what's funny was about 2 weeks after I left, somebody burned down a church on the, Sea of Galilee, and it turned out to be Jews that did it. But I said, if that would have happened while I was there, there could have been a big problem.
Mm, yeah, absolutely. I mean, have you said much about, because I mean, one thing that puts me off going to not just Israel, but even countries like Germany, is these Holocaust laws, because I've spoken out against the, the false Holocaust, and I've written about it as well. And it worries me that I'm now subject to arrest in Israel or Germany or what have you. But the actual, when you look into it, it's very, very unclear. The laws of these different 14 or 16 countries, some of it seems to apply only if you do it or say it in the country that you're in at the time that you're there. So, for example, when David Irving got put in jail in Austria for a couple of years, I think he just served one, it was relating to a charge on something he'd said in that country many years before, even though when he said it, there was no law against speaking or questioning the official Holocaust narrative. What are your thoughts on that? Because, as I say, I just felt when I mean, have you ever spoken out with views on the Holocaust? Or?
Oh, I do it all the time, but I did it in Canada and got arrested. I went up there. I was invited to give a speech. There's about 300 people there, and I gave the speech. But when I came out, and we were going to go to one of the other people's houses and have a beer. Well, the RCMP stopped us and threw my son and I on the ground with machine guns at our heads and arrested me, put us in jail for 5 days, and then deported us. But they didn't specifically say because we talked about the Jews. It was simply that they didn't like it. They said that I entered the country under false pretenses because at the border I didn't tell them who I was. Well, they didn't ask me who I was. I was in the back seat of a car, and these were Canadians going back to Canada. And I said, if you'd asked me who I was, I'd have told you. You didn't ask me. So anyhow, they banned me from Canada. But no, that theory doesn't hold water too much because the Farm Belt Führer, they called him up here in Nebraska, a National Socialist. I forget his name now, damn it. Anyhow, he gave speeches and handed newspapers out all over the place, and he was working in, I think it was Sweden or Denmark, and the Germans came up and took him away and put him in prison for 2 or 3 years. They actually, you know, almost kidnapped a guy out of another country. So I don't think that logic holds up too well. I could not give a speech in any of those countries over there. I mean, you know, I'd be arrested in 5 seconds because I won't control my speech. I say exactly what I want to say and how I feel, and that's it, and I'll never change. So I would be in jail all the time if I was in England or Germany or one of those countries. However, one interesting thing, I lectured in Japan a couple of times, and the Japanese treated me great. I mean, you know, I had dignitaries inviting me to dinner. I had a state dinner with people in the Japanese government. I gave a speech to 500 military and businessmen in Japan, and I met with the Japanese National Socialists, and I got along great in Japan. They treated me great. Even the chief of police of Tokyo gave me a set of swords when I came back to the United States. So it's interesting that Asian people treat you better than your own people.
Yeah, absolutely. And that guy, I just looked him up, Farm Belt Führer, Gerhard Lauck?
Yes, that's him. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, he didn't do anything in Germany except he did ship his papers all over the place. But anyhow, but he was in, I'm pretty sure it was Denmark, and he wasn't even in Germany. And the German government came in and Denmark said, okay, you can have him. So they kidnapped him, and he was in prison for at least 2 years.
Yeah, absolutely. He said he was in a German prison going on to the SPLC website. So just I can see that he went to prison there. March 1995, he was arrested under a law banning racist statements as he arrived in Denmark to attend a neo-Nazi convention. A few months later, he was extradited to Germany and sentenced to 5 years there for his propagandizing.
It's interesting. It's interesting, all these liberals that cry, and these progressives that cry all the time about your free speech and your right to gather together and all that kind of stuff. But when something like this happens to somebody we may like, forget it. You got no rights at all.
I absolutely agree. That's a point I've made before. Over here, we have like Amnesty International always running around the world about, well, this person, they said what they felt in North Korea, or they said what they felt in Iran and all these countries, or Saudi Arabia, and it's unacceptable they're being treated. Well, if people say what they feel on the Holocaust, then they can actually provide evidence of it.
Yeah.
But no one ever wants to defend them.
Right. Well, that's why I say that I think a lot of these revisionists should back off a little bit because they're like committing suicide. In fact, my theory is that the arguing about the Holocaust and revisionism has served the Jews more than it served us because they, you know, the minute they started revisionism up, and I was there at the time when it started up with Willis Carto and David McAuldin, up in L.A., and I said, I don't think this is too smart because now you're going to get the Jews all coming out with all their money with millions of dollars of propaganda against you, no matter how correct your theory is. Why don't you just say, yeah, hell, there was a lot of Jews died. There certainly wasn't 6 million Jews died, and leave it at that. But the minute they came out with this revisionism stuff and had all these guys going around giving speeches, well, that's when Hollywood opened up with these giant multimillion-dollar Technicolor widescreen movies to support the so-called Holocaust, which I remember in high school, we never heard anything about that crap. I mean, all the time I was going to school, there was no big deal about the Jews in World War II. There might have been a little bit, but most of the time it was sort of a ho-hum deal. But once they got people accepting the term Holocaust, that's what kills me. When I argue with a Jew, I said, that's your term. And you think that you're promoting that 6 million died along with it. I don't accept that. Now, if you want to argue about how many Jews died, and you say a few hundred thousand Jews died and they were persecuted and they were murdered, that's true. There's no use denying it. It happened, you know. But don't expect me to accept the Holocaust label, because that's a trap. Anytime you argue about the Holocaust, you're falling into a trap. Or you could be like the ruthless Hollywood Nazis and say, we don't care. You say 6 million people died. Look, 55 million people died in World War II, and most of them were white. So screw you, Jew. That's my position.
Exactly.
I mean, I'm not for killing, you know, millions and people and all thousands of people. That's not the way I operate. But I think we should separate. It's, you know, like with the blacks. I don't want to kill them. I just want them out of the way. Get them to go someplace else. Quit following us around. We go all the way to Alaska. And there's blacks all over the place. If we go to Mars, they'll try to follow us. You know, they hate us. We're terrible to them. We treat them bad, but they won't leave us alone.
Yeah, and it is the same with the Jews as well. I mean, what I really like about when I first started looking into, you know, who was responsible for what in the world and the Federal Reserve System and all these different things, what is good today is the nationalism and the truth seeker conspiracy theory, as they try to paint it, they've kind of fused together more. Whereas when I came into it, if you were looking at things like the Federal Reserve, things like who killed Kennedy, 9/11, all these different things, it was always government, Illuminati, and it was all very politically correct the way it was done. There was no racial element to it at all. But now, you know, 10 years later, we've got people talking about this immigration problem, people talking about the fact that the white race have been, you know, persecuted themselves over the last decade, century even, with all this immigration. And as you said, it doesn't matter where we go, these non-whites follow us about. They just will not let us live in our own environment. And when you look at diversity and this immigration, it's only ever one-way traffic into white nations. It's never, there's not enough diversity in Japan or China or South America or Nigeria. It's only there's not enough diversity in white nations. And when you look behind it, Tom, it always seems to be the you know, go back to the Hart-Celler Act in 1965 in America. It was Jews behind that. And at the same time, we had the Race Relations Act changing our racial demographic in the UK, same year, and it was a Jew behind that. You had Jacob Javits in America, plus all the B'nai B'rith. In the UK, we had Frank Zoxis, plus all the deputies of the Board of Deputies of British Jews, etc.
Well, you have to blame it on the ruling class, not the people at the bottom, not the street left. It's the ruling class, of which we agree on that, the predatory capitalists who create this. And the Jews, see, the problem is the Jews created Christianity, pretty much, and they followed the Christian thing right on in and took over Europe using the Christians. And now the United States has been taken over. The Jews all came over here because wherever the Christians go, the Jews are not far behind. That's why I'm an atheist. I no longer will have anything to do with organized religion. The Abrahamic religions are causing more warfare and death than anything.
Yeah,
that's another reason the right wing get all pissed off at me, because I no longer am a Christian. I see Christianity as Christ insanity, and it's just another enemy of the white race.
Yeah, I think on that basis, I mean, something. Oh, sorry, just before we move on to that,
sure.
When you work with one of the things that you united with the left on was you actually set up a war crimes tribunal in the Vietnam War for all the leaders.
Yes.
Can you recall that story?
That was quite interesting. In fact, that was back when I was sort of friendly with Willis Carto of Liberty Lobby and the Spotlight newspaper. And it was decided after talking to a couple of leftists that we'd have these war crime trials to bring the right and the left together. And so we got a big hall up in L.A. and put out the word, and right-wingers and left-wingers all came in there. There was, I don't know, a few hundred. And we set up a regular war crimes trial on all the leaders of the United States having to do with Vietnam. And we found them guilty, and if we'd had the power, we'd have hung them. But I thought it was a great experiment, and I wish it would have continued. But there is a draw. See, the right is very much infiltrated by the system. The right's not going to do anything that's very effective because they're too controlled by the system itself. They're totally infiltrated and so forth. Then they use these chat boards and all that stuff. And all these informants and everything crawling all over the right wing. I mean, back when the Klan was running around in the South, 4 out of 5 of the guys were government informants. I mean, you know, the right wing really has outlived its usefulness as far as I'm concerned. And I don't accept white nationalism either, because nationalism can screw up the white race also, the perversion of nationalism. I simply say I'm a white racial separatist, and if I have to go to South America to survive as a white man, I will. I don't have to live here in the United States, you know.
Yeah, so what you're saying is that essentially all you're after is a white racial separate area to live in with other white people, but it doesn't have to be tied to, you know, Belgian whites or German whites or American whites or English whites, for example.
Well, I've been pushing pan-Aryanism for 20, 30 years. I'm a pan-Aryanist, I believe. And I'll tell you one thing that led me to be a pan-Aryanist. I used to sell satellite equipment back in the day when we put in dishes, the big dishes, not these little ones. But anyhow, there was these wild feeds I could get from all over the world, and I'm getting pictures of people in the streets of Moscow. And I'm looking at this and I'm saying, wait a minute. They want these to be our enemy? You want to nuke these people? They're white. There are tens of millions of whites here. And I began to change my view, and I became totally anti-war and a whole bit, and a whole nuke thing, anti-nuke thing. And so then I said, we've got to team together worldwide and forget everything else but race. Religion, forget it. All this capitalism, forget it. All this stuff, bullshit. We're going to be pan-Aryanist. And so I was the one who started promoting working with South American whites. I mean, the Klan used to, anybody south of the border had to be non-white and no good. That's BS. There's millions of white people in South America. And they should be our brothers, you know. And
I was just going to say, last week I had someone on the show, a guy called Alex, who's from Holland originally, and he's been living in a white community in South America in Chile for years, And he said there's white communities in Chile, Argentina and Brazil, and they were actually asked by those countries to come over 100 years ago to farm the land. And they now speak Spanish rather than German, etc., but they've largely kept themselves white.
Well, yeah, they went over to South America after the Civil War in this country. And they went down to South America after the First World War. There was waves of white people went to South America. And I'm in contact with them all the time. And, of course, they say something about Spanish. The Spanish language, that's a white man's language. And I separate a Hispanic from a mestizo. A mestizo is a mixed-race person, and that's what's mainly coming into the United States. Hispanic is someone from the Iberian Peninsula of Spain, and usually they're white, or they're sure as hell a lot whiter than what other races we have to deal with. So I say, and also we make deals with Japanese people. I got along great. They respect our racism very much, and I had no problem there. Now, the Japanese National Socialists, they know they're not Aryan, of course, but they do like National Socialism, and I tend to be more of a Strasserite, I guess, original National Socialist, as opposed to the capitalist Adolf Hitler side of the National Socialism that was partially responsible for killing millions of people. And I don't see how we can use Adolf Hitler as a hero when he did so many things bad for the race. At one time, I was sort of pro-Hitler, but after studying it very in depth, I'm not anymore. In fact, I have some theories about the whole thing and all the Jews being deported and out of Germany and all that. And I don't know. There's something screwy about that whole deal because a tremendous number of German Jews were integrated, and they maybe had a Jew relative way back, but they had become patriotic Germans. I mean, you know, they were being dragged off and put in boxcars. That was something wrong there, you know. Jews are not a race. That's one thing people got to get through their mind. Jews are not a race, and if you give them respect as a race, you're working against your own interests.
You mean by that they're sort of mongrelized into other races? Or
Jews, the power is their integration into other races. That's their power. It's not being separate as a race or an ethnic bunch, which would be the best thing, probably for them too. But when they, we call them gene hijackers. They're like a vampire. And they get into other races and then get control. And they use Christianity, which is nothing but another form of Judaism. I mean, all our kids are sent to Sunday school reading the Bible. And the hell, two-thirds of the Bible is nothing but pure Judaism. I don't think we can win with the Christian religion on our back any more than we could win Mideastern people win with the Muslim thing. The Muslim thing is just as bad. Judaism, Muslims, Christians, if those were all out of the way, the world would be pretty peaceful.
How about your experiences? Because you follow, I follow Identity Now, and I appreciate that you've taken a line as an atheist now, but you had some experiences in your past where you met Pastor Bertrand Comperé and Dr. Wesley Swift and Colonel Gale, etc. I think you mentioned Pastor Comperé even gave you a 357 Magnum. I don't know if you still got that.
Yes, I do.
Have you got any stories you can tell us about your experiences through that? Because I believe at some point you actually followed Identity, but then you chose, you know, to move away from that.
I was very strong Identity. In fact, I became an Identity minister and under Reverend Comperé, and we were great friends. and also then Reverend or Colonel Gale, we were great friends, and Butler, Richard Butler, and I were really close friends. Even after I stepped away from religion, we were friends. But I discovered that by researching history that it's not true. We didn't come from the Jews. We didn't come from where they said and all that kind of stuff. And that story's been around a long time. And I gradually researched it all the way back, and it's incorrect. It's not true. But I do thank it for one thing. It radicalized me more. My time in identity, Christianity, radicalized me greatly. And so I appreciate that fact.
How about your experiences with David Duke? Because you saw him when he was very young, and he was a rising star, as it were, and you actually ran his campaign. So from when you first met him and your association with him and, running his campaign as well, what was the story there, Tom?
Well, I first met David Duke in San Diego, California. Actually, it was a identity meeting, pretty much. It was an anti-tax meeting, but it was put on by identity people. Anyhow, we were at the Anaera Hall in North Park in San Diego, and David Duke showed up with James K. Warner. And, of course, I didn't know of James K. Warner, but I didn't know of David Duke. And Duke had just been on the Tom Snyder Show and did a great job on there, really. And but anyhow, I met him there, and then they asked me, they're going to have a meeting up in L.A. at James K. Warner's house the next day on Sunday. Asked me to come up, and so I went up there and got to talking to Duke, and he talked me into joining the KKK, which was the farthest thing from my mind at the time. And, in fact, when I got home and told my wife, she said, "You what?" Joined the KKK. There's no KKK in my family or anything like that. So anyhow, because I was very impressed with him, he was in his 20s, and that was about 75, yeah. Well, then he was going to run for state senate, and he was looking for people to come down there and help him, so I went down and in fact, I drove James K. Warner's car down there because he didn't have a way to get it down there, so I drove it down. And so I worked as David Duke's campaign manager for the campaign. And guys came in from all over the place, all over the country to help him with that. And I remember he had two little babies, and they had one of these swings that you wind up and they'd swing the kids. And I'm sitting in his living room winding that thing up all the time. So I was there right at the beginning. But I began to find out something and see something about David Duke, that his feet were made of clay. And number one, he had this thing about women, and which I have a thing about women too, but I mean, there was no woman that was safe from David Duke. Everywhere he went, he was trying to make out with the women. I mean, clan leaders' daughters, clan leaders' wives. We'd go into a place to talk about politics, and he'd be wanting to make time with the gals in the office, the secretaries, and all that kind of stuff, and it's sort of sickening. And but I stayed with him then for some time. I know Louis Beam from Texas, he had the same opinion, was forming the same opinion of Duke that I was forming. And so later we both left David Duke. And I see David Duke as a pragmatist, a person who is, I know he's amoral. He's not immoral. He's amoral, because Duke's the kind of guy that you can tell him he's a rat or whatever, and he could just stick a knife right in your gut and smile and pretend he's your friend. I mean, he can't be trusted. And so anyhow, but just, he's always able to get a following. He keeps renewing his mailing list and keeps the money coming in. I don't believe in his phony professor thing at all. It's some nondescript university over in the far eastern part of Europe. And but I've said everything I got to say about Duke. He's just a womanizer. He ran off with $250,000 of Klan money and spent it on the gambling boats down on the Mississippi. He's done a lot of things. He tried to sell the Klan to Bill Wilkerson early on, who was a FBI agent and informant. I could go on and on about this, but it doesn't do any good because he has a way of conning people and they fall for it. And the books he's written, he's put out, and everybody says they're wonderful books. Well, they may be, but I'll bet you anything they were ghostwritten probably by some Jew. I don't think he wrote them, but I don't have any proof on that. So, really, I just like him to go away.
So you don't really have a lot of respect for him, really, obviously, from, you know, your experiences. You don't think that, because, I mean, for example, recently he was on the Alex Jones show, and he really put Alex Jones away with regard to, you know, Jewish control of financing, and a lot of people in the alternative media were really pleased with that, because Alex Jones is regarded as a shill. And so, you know, people see David Duke and as, you know, someone they can turn to, but you clearly don't feel that way.
Well, no, you could play the game. He's played the game successfully for all these years, and he's a lot like Trump, but, I mean, different personality, but he's a lot like Trump. I mean, if you were with someone and they took $250,000 from your organization and spent it gambling, what would you call that? I mean, you know, give me a break. He did all kinds of things like that, and he had one of the top porno operators in the Southeast running his office for several years, and it was paying him, I don't know, $1,500 a month out of Klan money or out of his whatever group he's got now's money. He was involved with a lot of shady people, and I see one of the guys he was mixed up with and just got arrested this last month as some kind of a big-time drug dealer, so... I don't know, the record on Duke is out there if anybody wants to read it. I mean, you know, I get tired of talking about it myself. I don't want to hear about him. But he's gotten new life. He's getting a whole new sucker list now with this Trump deal. The worst thing, if he really liked Trump, he wouldn't have come out and supported him because obviously it hurt Trump. So now Duke's got all these racists supporting Trump, which can do nothing but hurt Trump, no matter how you feel one way or the other about Trump.
What are your feelings on Trump, Tom?
Oh, he's a shill. The Republican Party was losing ground membership very fast, and that's how Obama got in. The Republicans were so fed up with their own party, they just stayed home. So the Republicans were trying to figure a way of replenishing their registration. And so they figured this out. Hey, we'll get Trump to run because he'll be a wild man. He'll be a showman. He'll really get it going, and he'll infer race and all this kind of stuff, and it'll be a big deal. And then all these rubes will run out there and re-register Republican. And that's exactly what happened. Millions of people have registered Republican, and they're going to turn out to vote that wouldn't normally have turned out to vote, which is just simply going to replenish the Republican Party. Probably Trump will be taken out a side door at the convention or before the convention, and the real guy they want in will be put in, maybe Bush or somebody like that. And Cruz is no better, so... I don't vote. I mean, you know, I haven't voted for years. I'm not going to vote for criminals, and they're all criminals. They don't, most of them are war criminals. George Bush Jr., he should be taken to The Hague. Cheney should be taken to The Hague. Here's another place where I agree with the left. These goddamn war criminals have to be dealt with, as far as I'm concerned.
Yes, by Tony Blair over in the UK and all the people that were involved with that, and that went on and on.
Same thing. Yeah.
It's a really interesting point that you make with this Trump deal, because I think, just paraphrasing what you said, basically the Republican Party's membership is dwindling. They don't want to put any governor, senator, or anything like that up there with ideas on race, because they don't want the Republican Party to be called racist. So if they get someone out there to say, I'm going to stand as a Republican, but I've got no affiliation in the sense I'm not a senator, I'm not a congressman, I'm not a governor, but I'm going to represent the Republican Party, and so therefore anything that I come out with on race that people could attack the party for being anti-diversity, as long as the party say they're against me as well, then people will come to the Republican Party through me.
Right.
Whilst at the same time, the views that I'm giving are not going to damage the Republican Party, because I'm not essentially a part of the Republican Party.
And all this fake stuff about we got to stop Trump is phony as hell. It's every time they do that, he gets more people on his side. You see, they know exactly what they're doing. The working class are all pissed off. Now, a couple of weeks ago, they had a secret meeting down at Jekyll Island in North Carolina. And it was the top people in the Republican hierarchy, and probably a lot of billionaires, and trying to decide how to get rid of Trump. I think it's bullshit. I think they got together to say, man, this plan is working great. And anyhow, how can you trust a billionaire anyhow? You could say he was Adolf Hitler's son, and I wouldn't trust him, because he's a billionaire. You know, when Ross Perot ran for office on a third-party ticket a few years ago in this country, he got on TV, and he said, he had $9 billion in his bank account. He said, you can trust me. And I said, I never trust a guy who's got $9 billion. Are you kidding? There's no connection whatsoever with those kind of people, with the common working man.
Absolutely. And we've only got about a minute left, but one thing that I remember hearing is you've stated that not enough is done by nationalism or white nationalists for the people that have gone before. You know, people don't look at the people that have spoken out for them before and tend their graves or pay any sort of tribute to them. And what are your thoughts now on what people should do about honouring those people in the movement that have gone before?
Well, we put out a list of where and a map of where they're all buried and their graves and all that, and we encourage people to go there and just go there and or maybe put flowers on a grave. But the right wing doesn't do this. I mean, you can do something and go to prison for 50 years, and they won't write you a letter. I mean, the right wing is totally phony, and the right wing racial part of this movement is totally phony. I respect the blacks. I mean, you know, a black guy can rape a 3-year-old girl, and you got black people supporting him in prison. I mean, it's totally ridiculous.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much for joining me today, Tom. It's been great having you on the show. And I want to thank everyone else for listening, and I'll be in touch with you also.
Thank you, Andy.